to the Weekly Leader Podcast, episode number 91. I'm Peter Mello, the founder and editor of the Weekly Leader Podcast and website. And my podcasting partner, as usual, is Pam Fox Rollin from IdeaShape. Hi, Pam. How are you?
Excellent, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. We've been away for a bit.
Yes, we have.
But we're back.
We are so back.
Yes, we are. And since we've been away, there was this little thing in the news about leadership called the presidential election. Did you pay attention to that at all?
How could I help but pay to that? Even though California was not a targeted state, neither, I believe, is Massachusetts, it's still featured prominently.
Yeah, ironic, isn't it? Massachusetts is the home of Mitt Romney and didn't do too well here. So what are your thoughts?
Well, the thing that stood out to me, Peter, is that Obama lost so much momentum in the first debate. It was really palpable out here. And it just showed to me how each time a leader goes in front of their audience, whether that's board, whether that's investors, whether that is their organizational in a town hall format, each time that happens, they're on the line, even though everybody has heard them talk before, even though people know that they're committed and in it and all that. And I fundamentally don't think it was about the debate format. I don't think Obama looked bad because Romney looked energetic. You know, he had an off night. And it's just a reminder how costly an off day can be when you're presenting to your peeps.
Yeah, you're always on the stage, aren't you? And especially with a debate. And I think there was some rumors that the altitude of something maybe slowed him down a bit, but he did seem a little flat at that debate.
I've seen it happen with leaders who maybe a particular format doesn't work well for them. They don't present well in town hall meetings, or they don't present well when they're doing investor calls, or they don't present well, you know, in some meeting formats. And it cost them.
There were a bunch of other elections or campaigns during that on that day that were, I think, pretty interesting. And here in Massachusetts, we had one. I don't know how much you paid attention to it, but Scott Brown was a senator who filled the position that Ted Kennedy held for decades. And he lost that seat to Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat.
I caught just a bit of it, and I caught a bit of her acceptance speech, and it was on fire.
What I actually wanted to talk about just for a second is his concession speech. So I wonder if I can find it on the internet. And if I can, I'll post it. But it was interesting to look at that and compare that to Romney's. And as uninspired as we felt Obama was in the first campaign, the Romney concession speech, I thought, was a terrible mess, frankly. And, you know, I think maybe it was part of an overconfidence. I think he really thought he was going to win, and the rumor was he didn't prepare a concession speech. So, and he looked like it, I thought, when he went out there on the stage. And I just wanted to compare that to Scott Brown, who was already in office, and he was the incumbent, and he lost to Elizabeth Warren. And you know, he's a Republican in Massachusetts, which is a kind of a rare bird, and his concession speech, I thought, was very powerful, made me think differently about him. It had humor in it. I thought he was a very gracious loser, and almost inspiring, if there can be such a thing as an inspiring concession speech. And I just thought that whole sequence of events after the presidential election, where it just seemed like we had to stay up, if you live on the East Coast especially, we're up till half the morning waiting for that concession speech. And it just was an interesting contrast between those two. So if I can dig up that speech, I'll post it on the website.
Good.
The other thing in the news is we've had this week the downfall of another American hero. And these things just blow my mind. We won't spend and waste a lot of time on it. But, you know, you kind of keep thinking about these people who hold themselves so high or seem to be held so high, and they fall so far, so fast. And we've talked before about many of these people, and now we have General Petraeus, who is one of the most decorated and recognized military leaders in our lifetime, and went on to become the director of the CIA and had a little affair. It all came falling apart pretty quickly. So, any thoughts on that?
Just the usual. I mean, really, this has happened darn near every time we record a podcast. And it's like, guys, can you wait until you're retired? But, you know.
Or ever. Why do you, you know, that's the thing. I guess this comes back to, we've had this conversation before about, you know, people, whether they be sports athletes like a Tiger Woods or some of the NBA stars, Kobe Bryant comes to mind, or, you know, we had, what's his name, Elliot Spitzer in the governor of New York. You get in these positions of authority and power, and I guess you feel you're invincible, invisible, and you can get away with whatever you want to get away with. But, you know, these people on the surface seem so apparently pure and maybe not pure is the right word, but they seem so straight-laced and always doing the right thing. And then we learn repeatedly that life is filled with interesting twists and turns, and what goes beyond the shadows behind the curtain. People's lives, I mean, they're just like everybody else, I guess, and sometimes not just like everybody else, because, you know, I guess we all know people who've had affairs, but it just seems like this just incredibly seems too common, I guess. I don't know.
Well, newsflash for people who are planning on some sort of indiscreet activity. Having a theoretically anonymous Gmail account will not save you. It did not save the head of the CIA. So, yeah, they're just, nowadays, there's not really great places to hide. And leaders in any sector are just in a huge position of scrutiny. And I'm sure there's a lot that goes on that never comes to light. But certainly, if the head of the CIA can't keep stuff private, nobody's keeping stuff private.
It never stops, really, does it? I guess as long as man has been on this earth, we've had these this story unfold. And next podcast, we'll probably have another one. So that's enough on that. What's your research report of the week?
It is on job autonomy and trust in leadership as the keys to improvement initiatives. This comes out of the University of Illinois. Some B school professors out there, Anand and Chajid. And what they found in working extensively with, I believe it was a healthcare system, is what seems kind of obvious, and yet a lot of people don't do. And one of the reasons why I chose this was Willa Selden, who we'll be hearing from in our weekly leader interview, talked about linking up the grassroots and grass tops. And you can think about that in your community, the people who are at the grassroots and at a poverty level and are community activists. And you can think about the folks in your community that have a great amount of wealth. But you can also think about that in organizations. And what these researchers point out in the findings that they had is that change in organizations, especially they were focusing on continuous improvement changes, happen only if those things are in sync. If the grass tops folks, the leaders of the organization, are credible and direct, honest, integrity, and the people throughout their organization have confidence in their leadership, and if the leadership gives the folks at the grassroots of the organization autonomy to do their job instead of ordering people to improve, darn it, and prescribing ways for those people to improve, if instead they offer direction and then support, coaching, opportunity, appreciation for people in the organization to actually make their own decisions about how their group can best respond to improvement opportunities.
Makes sense.
Doesn't it, though?
It does.
Sometimes I see stuff quite different from that in organizations. I see there is not much of a link between the top of the organization and the bottom. And when change comes out, it is either not credible when spoken by folks that people in the organization simply don't have trust in, or that it's far too prescriptive and doesn't match the realities and really use the brains of and adaptability of the people throughout the organization. So obvious, but, you know, is your organization doing it?
Oh, we talk about this all the time. Sometimes it's the simplest, easiest, most obvious stuff is the most difficult stuff with leadership. So, and the stuff that's overlooked. Your weekly leader interview, tell us a little bit about that.
It was such a delight for me, Peter, to talk with Willis Elton. I have heard wonderful things about her leadership, her perspective, her ability to work with all different sorts of folks. As we talk about in the interview, Willa comes from the corporate world, comes from investment banking, and moved first as a board chair and then full-time into nonprofit leadership. And she has led three of the iconic organizations in the San Francisco Bay Area and now works as a partner, I'm not sure exact title, at Bridgespan, which is a nonprofit that grew out of Bain, out of one of the folks that I worked with. He was head of the San Francisco office when I was at Bain 1,000 years ago, Tom Tierney. And Bridgespan does tremendous work in building leadership in the nonprofit sector and helping match leaders and organizations and really raise the quality of leadership throughout the sector. So I was really delighted to get a chance to talk with Willa.
Let's give it a listen.
Willa Selden, welcome to Weekly Leader.
Thank you, Pam. It's great to talk with you.
It's wonderful to talk with you, too. So please let our listeners know who you are and what you've been up to.
Pam, I'm a partner at the Bridgespan Group in San Francisco, and Bridgespan is located in San Francisco, New York, and Boston, but we're a nonprofit organization that collaborates with social sector leaders to help them scale their impact, build their leadership, and advance their philanthropic effectiveness. We also are really committed to creating opportunities for people to learn and to build on knowledge. So we view as a core part of our mission sharing what we learn through the client work that we do. So we have a very active presence on the web as well. Some of the work I've specifically been doing in our consulting practice really relates to working with, I think, some incredibly talented leaders on developing their strategies. And some of those folks have been Jeff Edmondson at the Strive Network and Maurice Lim Miller at the Family Independence Initiative, Patty Stonecipher, chair of the White House Council for Community Solutions. So a lot of my work has been in this area of, you know, how you really support communities in making effective change and pressing issues. So looking at areas of community collaboration, partnerships that can occur across organizations, and looking at the kind of those very tough challenges that communities face and helping to resolve those.
I've been really impressed with seeing the work that Bridgespan has been doing from afar. It was founded some years ago by Tom Tierney, who was head of the Bain San Francisco office when I started my career at 21 at Bain, and tell the story in my book about his decision about starting Bridgespan and really about that passion for taking some of the strategies and tools and resources and ways of working that work in the private sector and melding them into and making them available to nonprofit sector organizations. You've had a career that spanned the sectors. Maybe you can tell us kind of what that path was like and sort of how that has informed your Bridgespan work.
Good question. I started out my career on the corporate side, and really still at this point have spent most of my time in the corporate sector, if you look at the span of my career. But I've been actively involved on the personal side throughout my career in the nonprofit sector. So I've kind of played in both from the very beginning, I think with the exception of maybe 2 years in my career. So in terms of that, it's given me the opportunity to, I guess, play two sides. In the early part of my career, I very much was on, at the very early stages, very much on kind of client-side work doing investment banking. That's where my career really began. So I have obviously a strong financial bent. But then after that, really moved into roles where I had the opportunity to work directly for companies and spent about 8 years in the wireless industry at a very exciting time in that industry, putting together strategic partnerships and mergers and other kinds of relationships to really advance the company's work both in the U.S. and Europe. From there, I co-founded a venture capital firm. I was really interested in seeing ways that technology and health could be used to really advance society. And they're really focused on organizations that were either founded or co-founded by women entrepreneurs. So we also had a social mission to the work that we were doing. And so that balance, that brought together a number of my interests, both in business, entrepreneurship, and also in kind of making a difference in the world in terms of that opportunity. After that experience, I really began to continue to think about how I could make impact and where I wanted to make impact, and decided that I really wanted to get more deeply involved in the nonprofit sector. And from there, led the Tides Center, which was at that time really had a number of challenging circumstances it was facing. It was an infrastructure organization that supported 300 different nonprofit initiatives with kind of a number of aspects of back office support, and from grants management to financial, the financial actual work to payroll and HR. And so my business skills were extremely useful to kind of helping them to strengthen their services, but also kind of more strongly link a mission to how they were actually doing that service delivery. And then from there, led the Glide Foundation in the Bay Area that really has focused on, you know, how do you make a difference in the lives of folks that are the most disadvantaged in our society. And ran many social programs there, where you know, we were doing anything from providing 1 million meals a year to running a very successful and innovative health clinic, to providing services to children and families. So bringing that mix of both business interest in philanthropy through both my personal side of board work I had done, as well as the work of Tides, which basically is in a sense providing a set of services that help philanthropy to more effectively use their money in ways that that further the sector and strengthening nonprofits that can better do their work. It felt like a great opportunity to come to Bridgespan to kind of link together these various strands of my career, business, nonprofit, some engagement in philanthropy, as well as interest in kind of entrepreneurship, which I think is becoming an increasingly important area in the social sector.
Absolutely. And for our listeners who are beyond the Bay Area, they may not know that the Tides Foundation, the Glide Foundation, and then also KQED that I believe you chaired are three of the most iconic, innovative, powerful organizations in our area. And you led all of them.
Yes. And so, you know, I'd say that one of the things that has been about my career that I've really tried to be consistent in is really having the opportunity to kind of work with great people and work with great organizations that are strongly mission aligned and also committed to doing excellence in their work. And so that's been something that's been, you know, from the very beginning of my career.
For HBR case geeks, you may know of Willis Eldon's case and about the Tides Foundation and the challenges of coming in. And what most struck me about that is a classic leadership challenge in any sector, and sometimes especially in nonprofits, is the pace of change when you come in. And often we're brought in to lead organizations because they're at an inflection point and there's a need to make change. And people say, come in and take us to this next phase. But then the leader comes in and wants to diagnose the situation and then start making changes. And it's common to hear, not so fast. So maybe you could comment on that, what it's like to come in at that point in an organization's life cycle.
First of all, let me just correct it. I ran the Tides Center as opposed to the foundation, so I just wasn't really clear about that.
Okay.
But, you know, it's an important point. I think one of the the most important things for a leader to really understand is kind of what pace can an organization move at and what's required. You know, you may have circumstances where you have financial circumstances where you really have got to move quickly in order to prevent an organization basically, you know, cratering. And I would say at Tide Center, we were in a very challenging financial circumstance at that time. The organization had lost the prior year that I joined. I was on track to lose, I think, close to over $500,000 that year. And it's not as though we had a big pool of money to support that if that kind of continued loss. So we needed to make a number of rapid changes. I think a couple things that I would say about that. You know, one is, you know, what are the changes that are most critical that are needed, and how do you think about the kind of mindset shifts that are needed in order to make the change? So I think that in the nonprofit world in specific, you know, how people come to their work, the values that they bring to their work are quite central. And so the work that you do has to be, and the changes that you make have to kind of honor that and bring that, I think, at the forefront. And I've grown in my learning of that and being in the nonprofit sector. And so, for example, when I joined Glide, we kind of, in terms of the changes we needed to make there, and we really began with that at the base, as the base of the change, so that what we ultimately did could be owned by the whole staff, and they could continue and see that as a kind of in the fabric of the work that they were doing. And so that notion of how you actually link those things as you're making change, I think, is very, very important, so that you link both the values and mission orientation to the change process and why it's required. So that's what I would say about thinking about pacing. I think also with Tides, you know, we made a number of changes that we wanted to kind of also make visible to the staff. I remember at one staff meeting, things were moving quickly. We decided to kind of put up posters. We put a huge poster boards around all the walls in the room and basically had each staff person write on the wall by I think we did it, I can't remember, quarterly or yearly, but basically we had them put on the wall the changes, the critical changes that they had seen in the organization. And by the end of it, it was just such a powerful statement of what everyone had accomplished together and such a huge source of pride in that. So the notion of not only making the changes that need to happen on a, you know, monthly, weekly basis, but also kind of making that hugely visible so people can own it and feel pride in it, I think is also an incredibly important part of the change process.
Mm-hmm. One way that the nonprofit sector has struck me as sometimes ahead of the game, and I've also had a career that encompassed both sectors, is in noticing the links between people who work there and their values, the mission of the organization, and how that mission is delivered on a daily basis as we work in communities. And the interview, you did the video interview with Insight, with Oppenheim, a few years ago when you were heading up Glide, had some material in there I found really powerful. We'll put a link to it in our podcast notes. One of the things you talked about is how do you have a place that's so diverse where people can express themselves and where we can talk openly about some of the differences, differences in power, differences in background, differences in education, and also at the same time run very well, that we don't let the professionalism get in the way of showing up fully as human beings and inviting other people to show up.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that.
Well, I think one of the things, I do believe it's changing in our society, but I think at one point felt that somehow the personal was in conflict with the professional. And I think we are gradually coming to recognize that those things are intimately linked. You can't, you know, you don't leave your personal life at home and come to work. It stays with you. You know, problems that you have at work often show up at home and vice versa. So enabling people to actually bring themselves fully to work actually, I think, empowers the work experience, connects them more deeply to the work that they're doing, and creates the opportunity for you to better serve the clients that you're serving. in ways that are empowering to them. In the business world, obviously that's important from the standpoint of really understanding your customers. But it's even more important, I think, in the nonprofit world, where we really are dealing with, the lives of human beings that are so complex. And when you have an opportunity to kind of empower staff to really bring themselves forward, it helps you to also understand better the people that you're working with, and it helps those people also to see the organization as human and as connected personally to them. So there's a huge benefit from that. I think at Glide, and I certainly don't take credit for this. This is kind of very much in the DNA of the organization. But in the DNA of the organization is the notion of kind of mutuality and how you deliver services and how you think about the people that you're working with, and frankly that they are doing as much for you as you are for them. And not from the standpoint of the stories they tell you or from the good that you're doing and you can feel great about how you're doing it, but more from that experience of sharing and of kind of creating that common humanity and the way that you're interacting. And so we see that as important from the standpoint of mutual understanding, but also important to really know what it is that person needs at that moment. So, for example, in the health clinic, they go through a process of really understanding, what the patient and the client needs to have at that time. So instead of prescribing, here's your prescription, they'll say, these are some of the things that maybe you could do. Let's talk about, whether you're going to do them or not. Mm-hmm. On a scale of 1 to 10, where are you with this? And if they find that in their lifestyles, whatever, they're at a 3, then they're not going to prescribe that regimen because it's not going to be followed ultimately. It's really not going to help the person at the end of the day. So they really try to look at, what is this person's situation and what are their personal preferences?
It strikes me, Willa, that the quality of listening you're describing and curiosity and going from the other person's current mindset and point of view is deeper listening to someone of very little means, very little stature in society, is deeper listening than many highly paid consultants do to their executive clients.
Absolutely. I think that's right. I mean, I think that I do think that there is a bit of a, I wouldn't call it crisis, but it's a worry for me in our society that I do think that we are losing a quality of conversation and of listening that is so essential at all levels of what we do. Certainly in the consulting world, it's been fascinating for me to be here and to have the opportunity to kind of work with other leaders who, I have great empathy for, given the work I've done and the challenges I see them facing. But really understanding, I've tried to, at least in this work, to really think hard about, what is this person's true preference, not what's the best thing for their organization or what's the most incredible thing their organization could do. Because sometimes those things aren't aligned. If you're working with a leader that really doesn't want to run a big organization, and isn't even going to do a great job at that because of, obviously personal preference is going to drive behavior at the end of the day, then don't create a great strategy that's based on a big organization running, because they're probably not going to ever be able to implement that well and accomplish what's needed. So really balancing both the counsel that we give about what the organization ultimately needs to do, with, what the leadership capabilities are and then how they can transition that, I think is something that's quite important.
So now you're in that consulting role where you have so much wealth of expertise that you've gained for profit, nonprofit, leadership nonprofit, paid leadership nonprofit, board volunteer leadership, and you have, executive directors and board leaders in front of you who are trying to build communities. What are the top few things that you sort of see in common that people are struggling with right now as they're looking to lead organizations that bring communities together?
I would say a few things. One is, you know, how do you both create their opportunity for kind of strategic leadership and the leadership of professionals with the leadership of grassroots community leaders? So I think that integration of how you link both grassroots, grass tops, I think is one of the critical questions I think that many leaders are facing and are challenged by. And it's an interesting question because it goes back to the question you asked earlier about the time frame of work. You know, sometimes to link those two, you need to give more time to the effort. And we may feel that we don't want to give that time to the effort. And so thinking about, you know, both, you know, what's needed in that moment. And if it's not urgent, like as I said, if there's a financial crisis, you've got to deal with that. But if it's not a financial crisis that's driving you, then really giving the time to think thoughtfully about how to create that appropriate linkage is really important, and creating the opportunity for community to come forward to really help guide what the organization is doing, and to be engaged with the organization, because ultimately I do think long-term sustainability requires that the people that you're dealing with be a part of that ownership process. They're much more engaged, much more willing to make the change, to do the work, to stay connected if they feel themselves in it. I think it's one of the fundamental questions. And I think there's a continuum there. And so really thinking about, you know, where you should fall on that continuum, given your organization, given what you're trying to do, and given, you know, how closely connected community needs to be to it, I think is a critical question that many leaders are facing. Yeah, I think a second question really has to do with which I think also has to do with this notion of financial sustainability, which continues, I think, to plague the nonprofit sector. But I do think that you know, having leaders think much more thoughtfully about what they need to do from a financial standpoint, you know, really understanding, you know, what their key drivers are, really understanding what that means from the standpoint of a development organization, how that needs to be built and nurtured. And I think we're still, frankly, not good at that. I think as a second, you know, kind of what I would call gnarly issue that that often leaders are facing. And the third issue, I think, really has to do with, I would say, long-term leadership and sustainability of organizations at the organizational level. You know, how do you kind of create the opportunity for these next generation leaders to run and be successful and give them the opportunities to do that, you know, both in kind of building it into your organization and into your structure, and creating that means for that leadership, some of that leadership to come directly from the communities that you're trying to address. So not just from, you know, great schools, but from community directly. How do you create the means for you to engage community even within your own organization? So that means thinking about the kind of training opportunities, the kind of leadership opportunities that you give, really shifting how you're thinking about, you know, what leadership consists of, so that you recognize that folks that are in community that may not have traditional banners of success on their resumes, you really can bring sets of skills that are very powerful and can be encouraged then to build on those through education.
As you're thinking about what you might accomplish with BridgeSpan and beyond over the next few years, what's calling to you? What are the gnarly issues or the big opportunities that you say, wow, I'd like to find a way to grapple with that?
I would say a couple things. You know, one is this notion of how do we think about how we focus on partnership in ways that are really powerful. You know, obviously, there's been a lot of focus on collective impact. We bring together people across sectors to work on challenging problems in community. And I think collective impact is part of the answer to some of these things, and I think that there are also other forms of collaboration that are equally powerful. So really, you know, thinking about these other, thinking about the way that collaboration partnership needs to happen, and the social sector is of great interest to me. And thinking about that and ways of providing a set of kind of knowledge and tools around that, but also working with clients directly on those issues is of great interest. And I would say the second issue I raised earlier around this notion of how do you begin to link this grassroots and grass tops is the second area that I'm very fascinated by. Obviously working at Glide, I had the chance to kind of work really very much at a ground level, you know, with our clients and kind of being a part of an organization that I think does that quite well and unusually so. And there are areas that even for Glide, I think that there are areas that Glide could develop in as well. So it's not as though they're at the very end of excellence, I think, but they are certainly among the excellent organizations at this. But I think thinking about that much more strategically with organizations, I think, is one of the areas I'd also like to delve into. And I'd say the third, I'd really like to noodle this issue around financial sustainability. I think that has been such a challenge in the social sector, and I'd really love to kind of begin to have conversation and engage with people to really talk much more about that.
So you have had a busy professional career your whole career, right? It seems that there is more than enough that you would like to accomplish and that people are asking you to accomplish to fill any day, never mind weeks and years and months. So what do you do to recharge? How do you keep your energy up?
With as much humor as possible. That's really important. I have a 9-year-old daughter, and when you have an active, and she's a very enthusiastic, active kid that requires a lot of attention. And so I think she obviously keeps my energy up. I'm very focused on making sure I bring a lot of energy to that relationship. It's really important. And so that's a part of it for me. Also I have, friends that are also a core part of how I keep my energy up, and family, and, those are ways. And I really, love kind of a project my daughter and I are doing, building the 1,000-piece vampire castle of Legos right now. So that's been kind of fun for me. I think I'm enjoying it perhaps more than she is. and then I've kind of begun taking piano lessons, and I've been I'm on a break from that right now, but continue to play the piano. So that's kind of been a renewed interest that came back from my childhood. So I'm doing that. And I read regularly, so I'm an active reader. I'm in a book group I've been in for nearly 20 years. So, those things are things that really rejuvenate me.
Yeah. How about support networks that maybe bridge personal and professional, people that you turn to for advice and guidance? It's
absolutely.
To have a leadership role.
Yeah, no, there are. I mean, I wouldn't have like a single mentor. I really don't have that. But, there are definitely people that I always engage with around the work I'm doing, connect with over many years. I'd say I have a number of mentors that I turn to, and I actually don't usually describe them that way, but they really are people I turn to get counsel, advice about issues. I have no problem. In fact, I love trying to learn through the lessons that others have learned. So really reaching out and doing that actively, has been something I've always done throughout my career.
Yeah, we'd like to bring it up because sometimes people who are earlier in their career may not realize that some of the people that they turn to now for sort of the peer conversation down the hall, that if you keep in touch, they might be lifelong good thought partners for
absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely. I've had, some of my friends I've had for, many, many years that cross personal and professional and are some of my, greatest advisors. And there are other people I got to know through Glide and places who I've, stay connected with and who are wonderful advisors that I've really benefited from. So, I've kind of picked them up along the way and throughout my career.
What about social media? Is that something that you've been doing, Willa?
I do a bit of that, not as much as I would like to. So that's one of the areas I want to grow in. I certainly periodically use LinkedIn, or I don't really do a lot of posting to Facebook, but I do kind of read through what's happening to kind of connect with my network, and certainly have connected with people through that more on an individual basis. And then I read other people's work there. But one of the things I do want to do from a work standpoint is begin to use that much more actively.
Yeah, it can swell up time, so I can understand that, you know, approaching it thoughtfully and cautiously and strategically can really be an asset when you have such a busy day.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been doing some a little bit of blogging on the Huffington Post and doing that, and which has been kind of fun to do that. I'd love to do more and begin to use you know, Twitter and other means of doing kind of quick micro activity.
You know, earlier we were talking about sort of, in other words, going slow to go fast in organizations, taking the time to be thoughtful. If the place isn't on fire, then let's have the conversations. And that takes time, you were saying. And so many of the executive folks I work with are just literally scheduled back to back every 15 minutes. If they want to go pee, they've got to schedule it. Not to be crude, but it is brutal scheduling. And their schedules are available for anybody to muck with. And even at the highest levels, it is very difficult for them to take control of their schedules. And yet that's one of the things we wind up working on before we can even think strategically. How do you get blocks of even 15 minutes, let alone 2 hours, in your day on a regular basis so that you can have those conversations with other people in your team, with people who are reluctant to hear their concerns, with people who have ideas about how to move you forward, and also to have those conversations with yourself where you get to sit back and think. How have you been able to work that into your day?
I'd say with inconsistently. So I think sometimes I'm in the back-to-back. You know, I think that, I guess when I was running organizations, and it's been, sometimes I've been better at this and other times not. Sometimes I've actually just built it in that, you know, each week I've got a time that's for thinking time. And I think when I do that, that's the perfect way to do it. It's just to schedule in and make sure that you really hold to that as thinking time. You know, I'd say now it's something I'm actually working on right now, is kind of building in more time for that. I do find I have to think in the work that I'm doing now. And so when I'm doing that, I just stop and, you know, take the time. So sometimes I'm using travel time to think. Yeah, so plane time is great thinking time, for example. Other times...
I'm not sure I'm excited about the Wi-Fi that's now on airplanes.
Exactly. Other times it might be that I'm up early in the morning really thinking about something. So, yeah, I do think you have to stop. I think thinking is a really different process than activity. So it really does require kind of stopping, sitting, and simply sitting with a problem and letting it, you know, kind of be there with you and kind of running through some examples of that, and then giving it the time to kind of, for me, I have to, it has to kind of chew in my brain for a little bit. So I find I'm kind of also, you know, in those other moments where I'm doing other things, that same problem is still with me and I'm kind of chewing on it, and eventually, you know, something comes. But I do think that if we don't set our minds to what the challenge is we're trying to address and really have a clear statement of what the question is, which that initial thinking helps you to do, then even your time that you've got where your brain is working on other things, but you've got it in the back, it's also continuing to kind of chew on those problems. It doesn't have a clear sense of what they are. So it's incredibly important for leaders to take the time to stop and think and to schedule that time in and to make sure you're doing it. You know, for me, you know, fortunately, if I'm scheduled back to back, then I'm still doing it, but I'm doing it in my own personal time, whether it's getting up early in the morning or staying up late or whatever, doing it at times when I prefer not to be doing it. But you have to do it. I think ultimately to really both do the best by your organization, but also in terms of doing the best work that you can.
let's say that we could wave our wand and you could lunch with anyone in history, or it could be a contemporary person. Who would you want to talk with and what might you want to discuss?
One of the people I would love to talk with is Martin Luther King. And, you know, I think, and it is not surprising to choose a leader like that. But I think, you know, later on, in the latter parts of his life, you know, he'd begun to really think about this issue of poverty much more directly, and thinking about what needed to happen with poverty with regards to really addressing those issues more directly. And I think as we begin to understand more about poverty and recognize it's, you know, far beyond the issues of, you know, economic sustainability, and really I do think there's a strong spiritual basis that sits in poverty, that I think, you know, certainly working at Glide, that was really apparent, is that, you know, there's a spiritual deficit that can occur as a result of what happens in poverty, and what sometimes can either lead people to poverty or have people stay in poverty. So I'd love to talk with him about, you know, how you address that combination of things. How do we think about that as a society? And certainly that spiritual deficit can occur in people that are wealthy too. But as we think about, you know, really trying to shift, you know, what's happening in our world and address the folks that, you know, that need the most at this moment, you know, how do we think about that combination?
Yeah. So if you had in front of you someone earlier in their career, in their 20s maybe, and they think, wow, I'd really like to make an impact somehow in one sector or another, and, you know, leave this world a better place than I found it. What advice might you have for them?
You know, it's interesting. Increasingly, I see great leaders that are doing really phenomenal work, and, you know, and so much can be so quickly unraveled by poor leadership. It's at this moment in my life, I'm thinking, wow, gosh, where should people be spending their time? But I guess at the end of the day, you know, the work that we're doing is incredibly important, and trying to do the work that makes a difference and hoping that that work sustains is critical. But I think more importantly even than that is really cherishing your relationships, because at the end of the day, where you've really made the difference often is in the personal relationships that you've had a chance to affect, both in terms of those relationships at a professional level, but at a personal level. So really taking the time to cherish those relationships and give them the time that they needed, give people the mentoring time they need, give people the professional counsel that they need. Sometimes it's tough messages is incredibly important, with care, obviously, and with support is important. But I think how we are with other people is the thing that actually sustains, no matter what's happening in no matter the other things that can be unraveled and shifted and changed over time. That is something that sustains.
On that note, thank you so much for spending
Pleasure.
Your time here. I really appreciate the insights you have for us. Thank you.
It's great speaking with you. Thanks so much, Pam.
Well, Pam, that was great. I really enjoyed the interview, and especially my second career being as a nonprofit leader in the last decade. So I'm very familiar with the Bridge Fan Group, and it was great to hear Willa's what she's doing over there, what she did before, too. Very cool.
It just strikes me again, listening back to it, about the quality of listening. And sometimes here in Silicon Valley, where things move so fast, you know who the leader is in the room because they're doing the least listening, right?
Okay.
Looking at their iPhone, they're banging things out on their computer. Meanwhile, they're having a couple different conversations sort of chatted across the room, and people are asking them stuff, and they interrupt them, fire off a few questions, and there's a real, almost, I wouldn't say purposeful, but the lack of listening can be part of the leadership shtick for some folks here in the Valley. And it is so refreshing to talk with a Bay Area leader who has led tremendously visible organizations who really values the quality of listening.
Well, we thank Willa for being our guest this week. Fantastic. Any thoughts, closing thoughts about leadership?
This is a great week for leaders to go spend time with their families and have a really, really fabulous Thanksgiving. I've seen a lot of burned out, tired people who've been working very, very hard to make sure Q4 is enormously successful to their organizations. And I've had requests to do conversations with folks and planning with folks over Thanksgiving weekend. And I really hope everybody just takes it off and has time with their family.
That's always good advice. You need to recharge those batteries. Be thankful for what you got and take some time and enjoy it. Anyway, hope you enjoyed this weekly leader. Thank you, Willa Selden, for being our guest. And you can always get us by sending us an email at podcast@weeklyleader.net. You can go onto the website and leave a comment, and it's weeklyleader.net. Leave a comment in the podcast post or anywhere else you can find on that website, and we'll be sure to get back to you. Pam, it's been great getting back together, and I look forward to our next podcast.
Me too. And for our listeners out there, we are very thankful for our Weekly Leader listeners. If you're on Twitter, you can find us, Weekly Leader, @Weekly Leader. And you, sir, are @PeterMello.
I am.
I am @PamFR. And we'd be glad to hear from you and let us know if there's folks that you would like us to interview or topics you'd like us to cover.
Absolutely. So happy Thanksgiving.
You too.
Hi, this is Anya Parker-Lentz, and I'm proud to be a PodSafe artist.
Love.